Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Today, in honor of Halloween, we have a special holiday edition of the East County Magazine Show. Our staff has been researching some chilling ghost stories from East County's past, some dating back several hundred years, as well as the spine-tingling mystery of a large predator many witnesses say that they've seen in our region, a creature that has supposedly been extinct in California for decades. On Destination East County, we'll tell you about some haunting Halloween activities here in East County, as well as some other special activities coming up soon, from concerts and local theater productions to a telebration celebrating storytelling. And finally, we'll replay Raina Menashe's interview with La Mesa author David Schmidt, who will tell you about his new book, Holy Ghosts, based on reported hauntings at a local college, including reading a spooky and suspenseful tale. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride, who never made it to the altar and died along the trail, reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life," Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stagecoaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego, with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region, between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form. But some witnesses say that the Phantom Stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The Phantom Stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo Station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The Phantom Stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the Phantom Stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reached Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thieves survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. A prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing their frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large. Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tail of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine, which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost Phantom Mine, wandering the dark desert nights looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of three emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaqui Well, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the three travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other two men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other two noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The two men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The two men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaqui Well. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the emigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the three emigrants return to Yaqui Well. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaqui Well. One emerges from the brush nearby, and the third arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaqui Well in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired two other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had three ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around, but he ordered the other two ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost a million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Cahuilla Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and after a fierce battle annihilated the entire crew. The Cahuillas began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Kaweah did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s, after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancerna, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it. Perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with the fortune and pearls still out there in the desert? Perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades, but have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hakumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hakumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hakumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted. He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994, when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my Jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the Reader reported that a resident of Hapatool Valley south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wild cat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wild cats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brook, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail. In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Cahuilla Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub which can have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night. Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head and coal black fur that she believes was a jaguar. I sure froze in my tracks, she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears? Another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapa where a black bear ran across the road. But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingsong, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Devario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, East County Magazine.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This is Leon Thompson.
And this is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting Destination East County. This week's destination includes a haunted town hall in Ramona, a Halloween spooky spectacular in Spring Valley, and a scare trail at an abandoned amusement park in El Cajon.
Plus, we'll have previews of coming attractions, including a fall planstravaganza, a dinner theater show, concerts, a storytelling celebration, and much, much more.
Ramona's historic town hall will be haunted by ghosts, goblins, and ghouls on Halloween. This year's Halloween spooktacular will benefit Ramona Skate Park champions. Local residents have already reported strange sightings and spooky sounds at night, including eerie visions of costumed ballroom dancers in the windows of the main hall. Haunted Town Hall will be officially open for scaring on Friday, October 30th, up until 9 p.m., and Saturday, October 31st, from 5 to 9 p.m. Guided tours will be scheduled every 10 minutes by local area docents who will add some colorful and haunting history to the experience.
A San Diego Laurel and Hardy group, Saps at Sea, will present a Halloween spooky spectacular event on Saturday, October 31st at 7 p.m. at Trinity Presbyterian Church in Spring Valley. The event features Laurel and Hardy comedy films, a creepy cartoon, and guest comedians. The evening will also include a 3D treat as well as a tribute to the late John Locke of Lyric Pines Theater and more. Organizers promise it's creepy, it's ooky, it's altogether spooky.
East County's only haunted trail debuts this Halloween season at the abandoned Marshall Scotties Amusement Park in El Cajon. Rumored to be haunted by past park employees, Marshall Scary Scotties Scare Trail continues each night through Halloween from 6 to 11 p.m. This year, see the bumper car carnage, try to stay in one piece through the slaughter trailer and the haunted park offices, and visit the frightening Ferris wheel. Plus, don't forget to brace yourself as you walk through the remains of the Death Coaster. Marshall Scary Scotty's Scare Trail is packed full of spine-tingling, heart-pounding effects that organizers claim are so real they will keep you screaming for your life as you try to find your way out. For the chilling details, you can visit MarshallScaryScotty's.com.
Now for a preview of coming attractions. The Sheriff's Rental San Diego Station staff invites you to Coffee with the Community on November 6th, where deputies, crime prevention specialists, and senior volunteer patrol members will be on hand. Complimentary coffee and pastries will be served. Members of the community should feel comfortable bringing problems related to safety and security to our staff. A press release issued by the Sheriff's Office states, "Come out and make a positive difference in your community." The meeting will be held at the Rental San Diego Library.
The Grossmont Guitar Guild will present the Odeum Guitar Duo in a Tour of Italy concert on November 6th at 7 p.m. The concert will be held in the Cuyamaca College Performing Arts Theater in Rancho San Diego.
The Water Conservation Garden celebrates the fall planting season with the 2015 Fall Plant Extravaganza on Saturday, November 7th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. with a special members-only preview sale from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. The event aims to help San Diego gardeners make the most of the fall planting season with a plentiful mix of gardening experts and plants offered by local growers and nurseries. Visitors can attend workshops on gardening-related topics led by experts, plus visit exhibits staffed by knowledgeable garden docents and guest exhibitors to learn about water-saving gardening, edible gardening, compost making, gardening for butterflies, and more. Water agencies will share water-saving rebate opportunities for residents replacing thirsty landscapes with those that save water and are beautiful, too. And for anyone still working on their holiday shopping list, the Gardens Gift Shop will be overflowing with unique nature-inspired treasures that are perfect for gift-giving. For more information, visit thegarden.org.
Moxie Theater on El Cajon Boulevard in San Diego, just east of La Mesa, will present The Curious Case of the Watson Intelligence, opening November 8th and running through December 4th. The play tells the tale of four companions in a time-jumping tribute. Watson, the trusty sidekick to Sherlock Holmes, a loyal engineer who built Alexander Graham Bell's first telephone, an unstoppable supercomputer that became the reigning Jeopardy champ, and an amiable techno-dweeb who is looking for love. For tickets and details, you can visit moxietheater.com.
Robert Bonfiglio regularly performs with the world's top orchestras and symphonies, including the Boston Pops with John Williams and the National Symphony at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., called the Paganini of the Harmonica by the Los Angeles Times. Bonfiglio dazzles audiences worldwide with his constant reinvention of the harmonica. With his trio of Steven Benson on guitar and Joe Denenzon on the electric seven-string violin, they will perform classical blues and jazz. Robert has appeared on CBS Sunday Morning, The Today Show, and the shows of Larry King and Regis and Kathy Lee. The concert will be held at the Ramona Performing Arts Center on the campus of the Olive Pierce Middle School in Ramona. For tickets and details on this and other upcoming concerts, visit RamonaConcerts.com.
The Circle Players of El Cajon will be performing Wrangle at Red Mountain Ranch November 13th and 14th at 7 p.m. and November 15th at 2 p.m. This mystery dinner theater is set at a dude ranch, and attendees are encouraged to wear their Western attire and have a rip-roaring good time. Performances will be held at Richardson Hall on Farragut Circle in El Cajon. All tickets include a barbecue meal. For reservations or information, you can email thecircleplayers@gmail.com. The Circle Players are part of the Neighbor to Neighbor program of the First Presbyterian Church of El Cajon.
Telebration is a global celebration of the arts of oral storytelling. A smorgasbord of stories is awaiting you, told by some of San Diego's best professional tellers, representing the storytellers of San Diego, presenting traditional folk tales, literary works, and original stories on Saturday, November 14th at the Santee Summit Universalist Unitarian Fellowship in Santee. For details, go to storytellersofsandiego.org.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like to add to our calendar, or if you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, East County Magazine.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with David J. Schmidt. He is an East County author of the new book, Holy Ghosts, True Tales from a Haunted Christian College. My guest is also the author of two humorous romance parody novels, Pirates of the Danube and The Baron Rides Again. And he has also co-authored The Daily Book of Art and The Daily Book of Photography. Welcome, David. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you, Raina. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with your new book. I understand that it's a paranormal story taking place in San Diego, which is perfect for Southern Californian Halloween. And your book describes Point Loma Nazarene University as filled with poltergeists and apparitions. Tell us what's haunting this local university and why we should take these stories seriously.
That's right. Well, it's my book is a collection of nonfiction stories, almost all of them firsthand accounts that I've collected from people who have worked at Point Loma, who've studied there. And it's a collection of all these stories involving ghosts, poltergeists, strange things happening. Mm-hmm. As far as who's haunting Point Loma, the easiest answer to say is Madame Tingley. Now, Madame Tingley, Catherine Tingley was her name. She built the campus more than 100 years ago. She was in charge of the Theosophical Society, and they were a group of occultists. They believed in combining the ancient traditions of different religions from around the world. They believed in searching for ancient mysteries. Mm-hmm. And according to some rumors, Madame Tingley was into some darker stuff, too.
Ah.
According to some of the stories, they say she used to hold seances at what is now the campus of Point Loma Nazarene, back when it was housed the Theosophical community. They say that she would sit in her house with people, sit around a table, call up the spirits. Newspapers from the time, they describe her as a spirit medium and a fine trance reader. And most of the stories center around what used to be her house. Now, that building is now called Cabrillo Hall. It's mm-hmm. on the campus. It's used for classrooms, and it houses offices. But back in the day, that was Madame Tingley's house. And Cabrillo Hall, it's built with a very unique architecture. In fact, when you walk inside, you look, and the stairs are very tiny on Madame Tingley's house, Cabrillo Hall. It has very tiny steps on the staircase going to the second floor. According to rumor, the reason for that is that she wanted to be reincarnated as a cat or a turtle, and she wanted to come back and haunt her own house as ghost cat or ghost turtle. Now, obviously, a turtle's not the scariest thing in the world, but many students and security guards are afraid to go in there at night, get a weird feeling in there at night. And I've collected stories from students going all the way back to the 1970s and 80s. One student was in there working with classmates late at night when they heard a moaning coming from a closet door that was locked. Another group of students were in there late at night when they saw banging on the windows, heard the windows being banged on, saw the windows vibrating, but nobody was anywhere nearby. And so most stories center around Cabrillo Hall, Madame Tingley's house. But many of the stories center around places that don't have that much history behind them either. Some of the dorm rooms, the theater on campus, which are newer buildings, they have stories associated with them as well. As for the question of why to take these stories seriously, the simplest answer is that the sources are reliable. The people I've talked to, most of them are very skeptical-minded people, mm-hmm. skeptically-minded people. Some of them grew up and went on to become police officers, military personnel, the type of really analytical, mm-hmm. right-brained thinker type folks mm-hmm. who you would not think of as either superstitious or suggestible in any way.
Interesting. So without spoiling anything, could you tell us why, maybe? Did you get any sense of why she is haunting this place?
Well, a lot of the stories go back to the Theosophists and their history on campus. As far as why this campus in particular and why does it accumulate this kind of activity?
Right.
I believe that that's a mystery. I don't think anyone understands something like a haunting. And that's what makes my perspective unique from a lot of other folks who write about ghosts. In general, when you talk about ghosts, I divide most folks out there into two categories. There's two extreme ends of the spectrum. So one end is what I call the Scooby-Doo approach, and at the other end, it's the Ghostbusters approach. So the Scooby-Doo approach is people who say, flat out, there cannot be such a thing as ghosts or hauntings or anything of what we would call paranormal. And you know how that's how every episode of Scooby-Doo ends. They get to the end and it was a prank the whole time, or you know what they thought was a ghost. It was just a sheet hung over a chair, and they say, oh, it was old man Spunkers from the abandoned amusement park the whole time. Right. And I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you kids. And so a lot of people think that way. They think that our science and our understanding of the universe, it's already absolute and it's perfect and we understand how things work. So anything that falls outside of our understanding, it must be superstition or misunderstanding or someone's imagination. Now, the Ghostbusters approach, that's like a lot of these professional ghost hunters you see on TV with their equipment. And that's the belief that ghosts exist and that we understand how they work, that we know what they're made of, that we can detect them, we can record them with our devices. And I don't know if that's totally accurate either, because if ghosts are real, and I believe that they are in some sense, they're a mystery. I mean, that's why we call it paranormal in the first place. If we understood how it worked, we wouldn't call it paranormal. It would just be normal activity if we understood what they were made of, how to record them.
Right. So what is your critical approach to analyzing the whole topic?
Well, this book is for people who are not really sure what they think about ghosts.
Okay.
It's for a lot of those folks who are in that middle ground. Who
that would
don't
be me.
Right. Who don't fall into either the Scooby-Doo approach or the Ghostbusters approach. For people like myself, I'd put myself in that category. People who believe in the possibility of a haunting happening, of something from the past remaining in a place, but don't claim to understand how that works. And I think that's the healthiest approach to go from.
Oh, I see.
I think it's silly to assume that our science has already discovered everything there is to be discovered, but I think it's equally silly to assume that ghosts are something we can study and understand with our technology in the status it's in right now. And we just think about technology and science and where it was 100 years ago, 300 years ago, all the things that science had no idea even existed.
Sure.
And so in my book, I look at these stories. I do take them seriously because I believe the people who've told them to me, they're very trustworthy sources, without claiming to have a bottom line understanding of what exactly is going on or why these things are happening. But with that being said, I go through a lot of different theories. I go through a lot of critical approaches and theories to hauntings and to ghosts based on my research and what I've looked into about how we might understand this phenomenon that essentially is a mystery to us humans at this time. One of those theories has to do with quantum theory, the idea that the past and the present are next to each other, are parallel in parallel dimensions, and sometimes those dimensions bleed into each other. And sometimes we might see glimpses of the past, catch a figure, a sound from a past moment that has bled over into the present. Another theory is as far as poltergeist activity, a lot of researchers believe that that's not because of something from the past at all, but it's because of a present human being who is undergoing emotional stress, and that stress finds an outlet in what we call telekinetic ability. Now, telekinesis, it's a theoretical idea. Nobody's proven that it exists. There are some scientific experiments that I cite in the book that I looked into that show mild evidence that it might exist. But the theory is that some people have telekinetic abilities, but they unconsciously use them. So they make objects move around. The movie Carrie is the most extreme case of that. You know, the main character, she can cause cars to explode, which would be great if you're getting bullied at school. Unfortunately, nobody's figured out how to control it that way.
Right.
And which is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
But that theory is that poltergeist activity is caused by a human, not by a ghost or spirit from the past. And another theory is that the past has a way of imprinting onto certain places, especially when there's strong emotions involved. Those moments from the past that it can be very traumatic or emotional, they stick to a place. They imprint on that place through a process that we don't understand, but might be very similar to photographic technology, to audio recording. And that theory says that certain buildings hold on to moments of the past and continue to replay them on loop, that some people, for whatever reason,
that's an interesting theory,
can tap into.
Yeah, so maybe it's a way to connect us with the past so that it feels, so that it's part of our actual experience today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, one researcher, Peter Underwood, he's from Great Britain, he writes about ghosts a great deal. He suggests that by observing ghosts and hauntings, we recharge that recording. So if nobody was there to watch it, mm-hmm. according to his theory, it might eventually fade away and disappear, almost like an old cassette tape that with mm-hmm. time it deteriorates and falls apart. But he suggests that by observing, we feed into it and we recharge those memories that the place holds onto.
Now, you got your BA from Point Loma Nazarene. So did you ever catch hint of any of these happenings or ghosts?
Yeah, I've had a few experiences there. Nothing as dramatic as looking Madame Tingley in the eye, although I did do that eventually in a more abstract sense. At the end of my book, I talk about meeting modern day theosophists and meeting the modern day equivalent of the community that used to be at Point Loma. But I never saw her ghost. I did have some experiences though. I took my cousin and some friends of hers to visit the campus after I had graduated, and they wanted to do some ghost hunting. So we went, I told them the stories behind the places, mm-hmm. and we got to the theater eventually, which has a story about the ghost lamp and about the ghost Irving in there who makes the lamp explode when somebody mocks the ghost. So we went to the theater. They wanted to see the inside, but it was really late. We tried the front doors. They were locked. We went to try one side entrance. As soon as we walked around the side, the light overhead us turned off, and it's not a motion sensor light. Hmm. And I said, that's odd, but it's probably a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
We went around to the other side where there's some wooden steps leading up to a side entrance. And I said, let me try this door. You know, maybe it's unlocked. I went up to check the door, and I tried it. It was locked. So I turned back and I told my cousin, okay, I guess it's time for us to go. And right as I said that, I heard the doorknob jiggle, go back and forth.
Really?
And I booked it down those steps and I ran off, and my cousin made fun of me and called me a coward. But then she showed me that she had taken a picture of me right before that happened, standing on the steps to that side entrance. And in the picture, you see this faint little white glowing orb or ball of light behind me with almost a trail like it's coming up behind me. And I don't put too much stock in ghost photography and orbs, uh-huh. but the weird thing is that that photo was taken right before the doorknob jiggled.
And wow. Did she hear the doorknob jiggle?
Oh, we saw it jiggle. All three of us, me and her friend, all three of us saw the doorknob move back and forth physically.
Uh-huh.
And we knew that nobody was inside the theater at the time. And plenty of my fellow students, classmates also, and people who worked at the college, they all told me these stories when I was a student there. And that was where the idea for this book came from, because I started realizing that this is one unique place that has this huge accumulation of ghost stories about it. And it seemed anybody who spent enough time there eventually had some strange experience that they'd gone through. And as I mentioned, even really critically minded, skeptical people – like my brother, he went on to be a military man and a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
At the time he was when he was a student, he was a public safety officer, a security guard. And he went into Cabrillo Hall, Madame Tingley's old house. He went in there for the first time. He had heard the stories. He had heard from other security officers that they got weird feelings being in there, didn't like being in that building alone at night. And so he was kind of excited. He went in there for the first time when he had to do building checks. And he's in the building, and he suddenly hears this music, really faint minor key violin music playing. Well, he figured it's probably a radio somewhere. So he decided he'd try to figure out where the music was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
He moved over to different sides of the building. Everywhere he was, it seemed like the music was all around him. Next, he figured, well, somebody left a radio on. They left their computer playing music. So he checked all the radios on both floors of the building. Everything's turned off. All the appliances are unplugged. So then he went down to the basement to check down there.
Never go down to the basement.
Yeah, that's a horror movie 101. Never go down to
right.
the basement. But he goes down. Nowadays, the basement has some art classrooms in it, some art studios.
Uh-huh.
So he goes down in there, and it's creepy, and he's all alone with these linoleum floors, and there are these mannequins lying around that look like dead bodies in the dark light. And so he's creeped out, but he checks the basement. And finally, he goes into one of these art studios, and he finds this big stereo sitting in the middle of the studio. He thinks, oh, man, I found it. So he walks up to the stereo, and he starts to laugh to himself. Like, I was freaked out. I was
right.
afraid of nothing, and there's this stereo here. And he walks over to get a closer look, and then he sees that it's unplugged, and the battery cover's hanging open. There's no batteries, and it's not turned on. And he can still hear that music.
And it was coming from the radio.
It was not coming from the radio. It was all around him.
Okay. Well, this makes me want to go to the university and check it out myself.
Right.
Now, is Point Loma Nazarene University, is that on the ghost tour of San Diego, you know, the 100 most haunted places?
Right. No, it's not part of that. And in fact, this is the first book that's ever been written about Point Loma Nazarene's ghosts. None of the books, there's several books out there about San Diego's ghosts. Most of them focus on Old Town. They focus on the Hotel Del and some of the other more famous haunted places. But Point Loma's not in any of those books.
Wow.
It's one of the lesser known haunted spots.
Well, maybe the ghosts like that better.
I suppose. Maybe they like the solitude.
Now, David, I know that you're very well traveled. Also, you speak multiple languages, nine.
Right.
Nine languages. And how is traveling to so many countries and hearing stories from around the world, and how has that piqued your interest in the paranormal?
Well, if anything, it's convinced me that there's more out there that we don't understand than what we do understand. The more countries I've been to, and I've visited a lot of countries, have lived abroad. I currently spend about half the year in Mexico and half the year here in San Diego. I lived in Russia for a while, and if that's taught me anything, it's taught me how much mystery there is, how little of the world we really understand. A lot of us have this hubris about us, and we claim to understand how the world works. And again, that Scooby-Doo mentality of wanting to subject everything to our perception of the natural world, how we perceive it works. And the more you travel and the more you talk to people from different cultures, the more you realize that that's just one worldview. It's one cultural viewpoint out of many that are out there. Now, a lot of people, skeptical people, would say anything that sounds strange or paranormal or ghostly, it must just be superstition. It's because somebody was raised with these beliefs and they're going to see what they expect to see. Now, I think that can definitely happen. And I've met people who are superstitious and who are suggestible, and they're not the type of people that I usually cite in the stories that I collect and write about, because I don't think they are reliable sources. But I've met the opposite also. I think that it's possible to be suggestible and to be predisposed to see something if you are superstitious and believe in it. But I think it's equally possible to be predisposed to not see something if you have this prejudice that that thing does not exist. If you follow a strict prejudice that only the natural world, as I understand it, exists, well, that can blind you to things that may be there the whole time that you may not want to see or not be prepared to see.
Very interesting. Food for thought there. So in honor of Halloween, what is the creepiest brief tale that you can tell us right now? Is there one that you can tell us?
Well, one of my favorite is from Point Loma. It involves a security guard back in the 1970s. And it involves Madame Tingley's house, which the campus you can visit, just ask for a visitor's pass at the guard shack, and you can visit the campus and see her house for yourself. It's this old two-story white Victorian-style house. So this security guard, he's checking the house out one night, and they say this happened back in the 1970s. This was back when the house was located at a different part of campus. And in the 1980s, they dismantled the house and relocated it to the place where it stands today. But back then, it was located where the music building is. Cooper Music is located now. So he's walking through the house at night alone, and he's feeling a little creeped out. He's walking, he's checking the whole place to make sure that nobody's in there, make sure everything is in its place. He walks up those tiny steps that Madame Tingley had built for herself. And he's on the second story. He's up there and he hears a woman scream. And he thinks, oh my gosh, somebody's in trouble. Somebody needs help. So he calls out, who's there? Can I help you? And he runs down the steps and he thinks somebody's hurt. So he's asking, who's there? Who's there? Hello. And nobody's answering him. He checks every room on the first floor. It's silent. Nobody's in there. He checks the room underneath where he was when he heard this voice screaming. Nobody's in there. The carpet's been freshly vacuumed. There's no footprints in it. And he's thinking, what the heck is going on? He's about to leave, and he turns to leave, and then he hears the voice screaming, and she's still coming from underneath his feet. And he thinks, somebody's in the basement. Somebody's trapped down
there. Basement.
So he's got to go to the basement. Again, never go to the basement.
Never go.
And so he walks out the front doors to the building, and he walks around to the side steps, the stone staircase, leading down to the basement. He pulls out his key ring, and he finds that one old skeleton key that opens up the basement. And he has to sort of shoulder the door open, just like those cops in the movies do. And he turns on his flashlight. The basement's silent. It's all still. He's shining his beam around, and there's cobwebs and dust, and there's just a bunch of old tools, boxes stored down there. Back then, nobody ever went down there. They didn't have art studios down there back then. So he's walking through the basement. He's jumping as he sees the shadows, and he thinks he sees monsters and ghosts, but it's just tools and boxes. Nobody's down there at all. He sees the dust on the floor. There's no footprints. So he turns to leave. He figures, well, whatever. Who knows? I don't know why I heard that. Turns off his flashlight, turns toward the door, and then he hears the voice screaming again, and it's still coming from underneath his feet. Now he's in the basement. There's nothing under the basement. So he just runs. He drops his flashlight. It shatters. He runs out. He runs back to public safety headquarters. And nobody believes him. They all make fun of him. They tell him he's going crazy. And they poke fun of him for months after that. And then they forget about it. And they forget this story until a couple of years later when they dismantled the building and they moved it across campus to where it stands today. So they took it apart piece by piece all the way down to the basement. When they got to the wooden floorboards of the basement, as the story goes, they pulled up those wooden floorboards. They find a human skull lying in the earth underneath the basement.
Wow.
Lying face up with its mouth open like it was screaming for all eternity.
And it was a woman.
And according to the story, it was a woman. Now, again, that's how the story goes. But did it actually happen? Well, to find that out, you're going to have to read my book, Holy Ghosts, True Tales from a Haunted Christian College.
Well, that's great. You're quite the storyteller. One last question before I let you go. What are you working on next? Will it be more scary stories or something else?
Absolutely. I have a whole series of scary stories I'm working on right now. It's the Tiny Staircase series, named after Madame Tingley's staircase in Cabrillo Hall. This is a series of short ebooks that I'm putting out on Amazon. They're all available on Amazon and on my website, which is holyghoststories.com. Holyghoststories.com is my website. And you can find the newest installations in the Tiny Staircase series on the website. If you go there, you can also find out how to get a free ebook, one of the books in the Tiny Staircase series, which is called Ghosts Recordings from the Past, which goes into that theory of the past imprinting on places. So over the next few months in the future, I'll be releasing more and more installments in that series, the Tiny Staircase series. I'm also working on a book about my search for the little people legends in Mexico, the little people known as the Duendes or the Chaneques in Mexico. This book will be Into the Chaneques Cave, and it will tell the story of my going into a cave where they say these mysterious, legendary little people live in the mountains of Oaxaca in southern Mexico. And so that book will be coming out sometime next year, Into the Chaneques Cave.
Great.
And then more and more ebooks about ghosts, hauntings, and all these mysteries that surround us. Again, I believe that there's much more that we don't understand than what we do understand.
Wow. Well, we look forward to seeing them. Our time is up, David, but thank you so much for joining us, and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. Happy Halloween, and happy Dia de los Muertos to everyone out there.
Again, for more information on David J. Schmidt and his work, please visit his website at holyghoststories.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, East County Magazine.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.